You're listening to an audio recording of a workshop session from the Gospel Coalition's 2018 Women's Conference.
This is Living Sacrifice, Learning from the Life of Helen Roosevere. My name is Betsy Howard. I've spent the last year reading all of Helen Roosevere's books, and it's been a wonderful experience to me. And I love Helen Roosevere, and some of you may already love her. If not, I hope you'll have a better feel for her after this talk, and that you'll be inspired to read her books, and that you'll love her as much as I do. So I haven't given you any handouts today, but I wanted you to have a timeline and also access to a list of all her books after this session. So if you would like that, you can find, I've put it online at helenroosevere.com. If you just go to helenroosevere.com, I've got a timeline and all of her books there. Because as I started doing my research, I couldn't find anywhere that listed her books in the order they were written or that kind of thing. So I put that together. One other note is from 1876 up until now, the country in which Helen Roosevere ministered has been known by five different names. It was the Congo Free State, the Belgian Congo, Republic of Congo Leopoldville, the Republic of Zaire, and it's currently the Democratic Republic of Congo. For simplicity's sake, throughout this talk, I'm just going to refer to it as the Congo, regardless of what its legal name was at the time. The mother died in childbirth. Not Helen's mother, but one of her patients at the mission hospital. She left behind a premature newborn and a two-year-old daughter. Keeping the baby warm was essential for it to survive, but the hospital didn't have an incubator or electricity, so they relied on hot water bottles to warm newborns. Well, one of Helen's pupils went to fill up a hot water bottle and it burst, and it turned out it was the last one in the whole hospital. So throughout the night, one of the midwives slept with the baby by the fire, and it made it through the night. The next day, Helen gathered a group of orphans who lived at the mission for a time of prayer. She told them about the baby and the big sister and the need for the baby to stay warm in order to survive. She asked them to pray, but she was really thrown off by the prayer of a little 10-year-old girl named Ruth. And she said, "Please, God, send us a hot water bottle. It'll be no good tomorrow, as the baby will be dead. So please send it this afternoon. And while you're at it, would you please send a dolly for the little girl so she'll know you really love her?" So this prayer may not sound audacious to us, but Helen knew that it was basically an impossible request. There were no pharmacies selling hot water bottles anywhere near their mission station. Later, she wrote about her thoughts, and she said, "The only way God could answer this particular prayer would be by sending me a parcel from the homeland. I had been in Africa almost 4 years at that time, and I had never received a parcel from home. Anyway, if anyone did send a parcel, who would put in a hot water bottle? I lived on the equator." Well, much to Helen's surprise, that very afternoon, a large box from England, the first she had ever received, arrived on her doorstep. Well, she had to call together the orphans who'd prayed that morning, and they opened it together. She carefully untied the string and removed the paper, and the children's anticipation was just growing and growing. Well, the box contained colorful knitted jerseys and bandages for her patients. There was soap. There was a box of raisins, and then Helen pulled out a hot water bottle. She couldn't help crying as she realized how small her faith had been, and the little girl, Ruth, immediately said, "Well, if God sent the bottle, he must have sent the dolly, too." Sure enough, the last thing in the box was a beautiful baby doll. That package had been on its way for 5 months before Ruth prayed her prayer. Helen Roosevere was born in 1925 in Hertfordshire, England. She was the second of Martin and Edith Roosevere's five children. The family was well-educated, but they weren't especially well-off. Martin bounced around between different teaching and civil service jobs. Helen and her siblings were sent to excellent British boarding schools, but she often found herself without adequate pocket money to enjoy the amusements her fellow classmates took for granted. In 1939, when Helen was just 14 years old, Great Britain declared war on Germany. The Roosevere family was fully involved in the war effort. Bob, Helen's older brother, worked as a codebreaker at Bletchley Park. Her father, Martin, worked for the Ministry of Food, where he played a key role in developing and implementing the fraud-proof ration book. In fact, he was later knighted by the Crown for his service in developing the ration system. Helen, at the time, was in boarding school in North Wales, which meant that, in spite of the Blitz happening in London, she had to travel through London to get to her parents' home in Kent. One time, she was caught in a terrifying air raid and actually saw a woman killed. The Roosevelt family was only moderately religious. Helen attended Sunday school as a little girl and was confirmed in the Church of England. Yet her inherited faith didn't answer her questions about the meaning of life or absolve her guilt over her sins. When she was a teenager, her spiritual hunger and her love of beauty drew her to the Anglo-Catholic Church, where she would regularly make confession to a priest. For those of you unfamiliar with Anglo-Catholicism, it's a kind of Anglican church that holds many of the same doctrines and practices that the Roman Catholic Church does, but is not under the authority of the Pope. Every time Helen would go to confession, she would feel great relief, but the relief wouldn't last. She said, "Whilst in church, I could lose myself to all the problems, bathed in the strange mysticism and pious ritualism. But on leaving the service, I had nothing, no power, no companion, no help to answer the daily needs and meet the daily problems." She still felt life was pointless, and she escaped to the movies as often as she could to fill her emptiness. In 1944, Helen matriculated to Newnham College, Cambridge, a women's college, where she excelled at cricket and hockey. She chose to study medicine, and the need for wartime doctors put her on an accelerated track. From the first day she was there, evangelical Christian students began to reach out to her as a friend. After a while, she started attending their Bible study and meetings of the Christian Union. On Sundays, Helen still attended a little Anglo-Catholic church in Cambridge, but she found no community there. In spite of all this religious activity, in her own later estimation, Helen was still unconverted at this point. Then, in the providence of God, Helen's younger sister caught the mumps. Helen herself had never had the mumps, and since it was especially dangerous for adults, her parents advised her not to come home for the Christmas holidays. A couple of friends invited her to come with to their families for Christmas, but it still left the rest of a long vacation to fill. So Helen agreed to attend a Christian house party where student leaders were being trained. She felt very out of place among the other girls, who were student leaders. They were wealthier and more knowledgeable about the Bible than she was, but she eagerly participated in the training. After she learned a new Bible study method, Helen decided to apply it to the book of Romans. She got so engrossed that she didn't stop until she reached the end of the book, at which point she realized she had stayed up all night. On the last day of the house party, some of the other students challenged Helen on her more Catholic beliefs, such as her view of communion. She lost her temper at this and then retreated to her room in shame over her lack of self-control. This is what she wrote about that day in her book, Give Me This Mountain. "Suddenly, I flung myself on my bed in a flood of tears and loneliness. With an overwhelming sense of failure and helplessness, I cried out to God, if there was a God, to meet with me and to make utterly real and vital to me himself. I raised my eyes and through my tears, read a text on the wall, 'Be still and know that I am God.' That was all. Immediately, the whole burden fell away in a moment. For years, the Holy Spirit had been opening my eyes to a sense of sin, convicting me of my unworthiness before a holy God. But now came the wonderful gift of repentance. God poured out his grace and forgiveness in cleansing from all the uncleanness of sin, and in revealing, at this time, the amazing wonder of the friendship of Christ." So in spite of the fact that she'd been reading her Bible and growing in her understanding of God for some time, this was the moment when she trusted him to save her and truly believed that he did. The next few years were joyful ones as Helen grew in her faith and saw others come to Christ through her witness, including the leader of the Cambridge University Women's Communist Party. After Cambridge, she continued her medical training at West London Hospital. Helen felt called to practice medicine on the mission field, so she joined the World Evangelization Crusade, a missions agency that had been founded in 1913 by missionary C.T. Studd. Studd himself had started the WEC mission in the Congo 30 years before, but there was still no doctor there. Helen accepted the call to work for the WEC in the Congo. after spending time in Belgium learning French. On February 13, 1953, Helen Roosevere set sail for Africa. Helen began her career in the Congo at the Ibambi Mission Station, led by Jack and Jesse Scholes. She was thrilled to be there and was warmly welcomed by everyone at Ibambi. Since there was no other doctor, she immediately began seeing patients, in spite of the many language barriers. Because not only she had to learn French, but then there were also many tribal languages that they spoke. Her day would begin with tea at 5 a.m., followed by communal morning prayer and Bible study, and then she would begin seeing patients at 9 a.m. and described her days this way. Noise, heat, smells, waves of nausea, everyone talking at once, crying babies, running sores. It was dusk before all had drifted off, and I was left cleaning the room, sorting out what there was of drugs, frantically making lists of what we urgently needed, almost overcome by waves of weariness, and in the background, a slight dread of inability to cope. Then came supper, family Bible study and prayers, cocoa, and so to bed about 10 p.m. In the beginning, Helen had no helper. She quickly realized the need to train nurses. God sent her one, named John Mangadima, who would turn out to be her right-hand man through all her years in the Congo. She also took on 7 schoolboys as trainee nurses. Helen thrived as a teacher. She would later say that teaching was a much more natural calling for her than medicine was. When she practiced medicine, she felt really depleted and exhausted. When she taught, she felt energized. It was a huge accomplishment for her when, in 1955, 4 of her nursing students passed their state nursing examinations. Life in the Congo was hard. Helen often had to drive many miles to villages, and more often than not, her vehicle would break down or get stuck in the mud, sometimes in the middle of the night. There were all kinds of bugs, including a stinging red fly that infected Helen with painful parasites. No treatment was ever successful at curing them, and she lived with them for the rest of her life. Helen had frequent serious illnesses, including recurrent bouts of tonsillitis and malaria, amoebic dysentery complicated by hepatitis, cerebral malaria, and tick-borne typhus fever. Each time she was sick, she was cared for lovingly by Africans and other missionaries. Yet, she chafed at her own bad health. She said, "Each time I was ill, another African or missionary who already had a full workload had to give time to care for me. Someone else had to undertake my work in addition to his own. After each illness, I became so depressed and discouraged, sensing that I was becoming a burden to the team and should go home. What was God trying to say to me?" As she kept wrestling with the question, she finally came to a place of acceptance, saying, "Since I first went to Africa, I had prided myself that all my needs were met in and by the Lord Jesus Christ. I felt it was wrong to need Africans or missionaries. For years, I was the only missionary doctor in our area, so I was always needed. I was thus on the giving end, and the African was on the receiving end, always saying thank you. This equally soon can become demoralizing. I had not seen that the roles needed to be reversed if the Africans were to know the sense of fulfillment and joy and being needed that I knew." Towards the end of her first year in Africa, a man showed up at Helen's door and told her that he had come to be her cook. He had had to leave his previous employment because he was infected with leprosy. Although Helen was not afraid of leprosy, her heart sank at the thought of all that it would entail to treat a leper. There was still a huge stigma against leprosy, to the point that lepers would have to be treated in a separate building with separate equipment. She was already working 18 hours a day. However, God wouldn't let her refuse. They built a small mud and thatch building to be the leprosy clinic and ordered supplies of leprosy drugs. The bill for the leprosy medicine came to 4,320 Belgian francs. Helen didn't have the money to pay the bill, but she figured since God was the one who had moved her to treat leprosy patients, he would supply the money. She put the bill in her Bible and waited, but no money came. It was mission policy that all bills had to be paid by the end of the month. The last day of the month came, and Helen didn't have the money. She didn't even have a reserve fund to draw from. She felt aggrieved that God had not provided the funds for the work that he had thrust on her. Then, midday, someone brought Helen an envelope addressed to her. It was 3 different donations. The total amount was 4,800 Belgian francs. Helen calculated that minus a tithe of 480 francs, she would have the exact amount to pay the bill for the medicine, 4,320 francs. That exact amount was made up from three different gifts: a gift from the Girls Crusader Union in England, a gift from two prayer partners in Ireland, and a gift from a couple in North America that Helen didn't know. That North American gift had been en route for 4 months. Two of the gifts had been marked for your leprosy work. At the time they were sent, Helen had no plans to work with lepers. While all this was going on in Africa, life at home didn't stand still. Helen's parents separated in 1954 and divorced a couple of years later. In all of her books, Helen never directly discusses her parents' divorce, but her father said this about it in his own memoir. "Here I must record that behind all the activities I've mentioned, home was not a happy home. The war had separated Edith and me in more ways than one, and in the 10 years that followed, we never managed to revive a sense of companionship. Early in 1954, I removed myself." After the divorce, her father moved to Malawi and became the headmaster of a school. He remarried and lived there for the rest of his life. Helen's mother never remarried, and Helen felt torn about leaving her alone each time she went to Africa. In 1955, when Helen had been in the Congo for a couple of years, she met another doctor there who had a vision for creating a specialized hospital for leprosy. He and Helen decided it would be ideal to combine the nurse training program overseen by her with a leprosy hospital that he would oversee. Helen assumed that this would be built at her beloved Ibambi mission station, where she'd invested 2 years creating a functioning clinic, a 32-bed hospital, and a medical dispensary. She was dismayed and incensed when the mission leaders told her they wanted her to move her nurse's training school 7 miles away to Nebabongo, where they had a small mission orphanage. It would mean starting over. Helen fumed and argued with the committee, but eventually prayed and submitted to the decision to build a new hospital and nurses training school at Nebabongo. This required hard physical labor. The buildings that they occupied had lain vacant for 2 years, and the jungle had taken over. Helen hauled bricks from the kiln and negotiated with local suppliers for building materials. The manual labor made it difficult for her to start training nurses or seeing patients. She felt really resentful about this, and she asked some of the African Christians to pray for her. After praying, one of the men spoke up. "Doctor," he said, "when you are being a doctor, in your white coat, stethoscope round your neck, speaking French, you are miles from us. We fear you and all say, 'Yes, yes,' hardly even hearing what you said. But when you are down at the kiln with us, and your hands are rough as ours are, when you are out at the markets using our language and making howlers and we all laugh at you, that's when we love you and how we have come to trust you and can listen to what you tell us of God and his ways." This humbled Helen and opened her eyes to the ways God could use what she considered a distraction to make her a more effective missionary. Eventually, Helen was able to concentrate on medicine again, and the hospital at Nebabongo flourished. In addition to doing surgery and training nurses, once a week Helen would drive 60 miles to Wamba to get supplies. 1 week, Helen arrived home from her supply trip exhausted. It was after 10 p.m., but someone had left a plate of dinner for her. She consumed one mouthful and decided she was too tired to eat, so she gave the rest of the food to the dog who was at her feet begging. Later that night, she became violently ill. The next morning, one of her helpers found the dog dead on the floor and Helen delirious. She had been poisoned, and then while she suffered, her poisoners stole everything they could from her house. This kind of thing happened a lot to Helen, and it evokes in me two responses. The first is amazement at God's protection. If Helen had eaten the whole meal, it would have been her rather than the dog who would have been dead. On the other hand, why did God let Helen get robbed? She had worked so hard and sacrificed so much, surely God could have spared her this trial. Or consider another time when the thatch roof of Helen's cottage started to leak. She waited until the dry season when she knew she could expect 5 weeks without rain. They stripped off the thatch one day and planned to put on corrugated sheet metal the next day. Helen went to sleep under the stars, but she woke up soaked in rain. All of her possessions were drenched in an inch of muddy water, including her precious books. The books had been treated with shellac to prevent mold in the humid climate, but now that they were wet, the shellac made them a sticky mess. Helen believed that God allowed this sort of hugely inconvenient trial to give her an opportunity to count it all joy, no matter what her circumstances. She knew that someday, in hindsight, she might see God's purpose, but she needed to give thanks in the present. This was not easy for her, but she did it. Her thanksgiving was interspersed with tears, but she chose to rejoice in the Lord by faith. When Helen left for the mission field, she knew she might never marry. She did have a proposal from another missionary in her early years in Africa, which she refused. I think perhaps that most days when she was in the Congo, she was too busy to be lonely. But by the time she went on her first furlough in 1958, Helen was tired of being single on the mission field. She told God that she wanted to return to the Congo with a nice surgeon for a husband. She wanted someone to help shoulder the responsibility, to undertake all the physical labor that was usually reserved for a man, but so often fell to Helen. While doing some additional medical training at home in England, she met a devoted Christian doctor. He seemed to be an ideal fit for her plans, but he didn't have any call to the mission field. Gradually, Helen's desire shifted from wanting to return to the Congo with a husband to simply wanting this man to be her husband. She asked God to release her from her missionary call. Although they had a godly dating relationship, Helen's spiritual life dried up. She knew she was following her own desires rather than the calling that God had put on her life. Finally, Helen surrendered to God's leading. She and her suitor agreed not to see each other again. And Helen went back to Africa at peace. Although she might have had the right to marry, she had laid that right down. She said she had wanted a husband so that she could pass the buck, but she sensed that God was saying, "Pass the buck to me." In later years, when asked how she handled her singleness, she would respond that she was in love with Jesus. He was her protector and keeper. She didn't always feel resigned to singleness. There were times where she very much wanted physical arms around her, but she always found God faithful. For example, one time the hospital was badly in need of antibiotics and anti-malarial drugs. Unexpectedly, they received a truck full of medical supplies from a relief agency. But Helen's joy went flat as she determined that the crates contained none of the needed medicines, rather they were full of anticoagulants, mysterious pills with labels in foreign languages, and other medications not routinely needed in the jungle, along with 48 bottles of an unknown liquid. After scrutinizing the labels, Helen decided the fluid was an antidote to a rare type of poisoning unknown to her patients. Less than a week later, patients started streaming into the hospital in respiratory distress. Twin babies that couldn't breathe. Adults vomiting. The patients kept staggering in on the verge of collapse. Several died before Helen could do anything for them. Finally, they figured out what had happened. At a village about 5 miles away, they'd had a wedding the day before. Some of the women were afraid they were going to run out of food, so they went out and gathered wild yams to add to the feast. Wild yams were notoriously dangerous, and they were the cause of this illness. Every single person who ate the yams was violently sick. Helen sent men with stretchers to the village to bring back those who were not well enough to walk to the clinic. She had her students ready the wards, hanging up hooks and gravity to administer IV drips. And she opened up the box that contained 48 bottles of the antidote for rare food poisoning. Over 20 people died that day, but every single one of the 48 people who received the antidote recovered. And so she kept on walking by faith, even when God's purposes were hidden. When Helen had become a Christian on that holiday house party, a Bible teacher who was there named Graham Scroggie had written Philippians 3:10 in her Bible, "That I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death." On that winter day in 1945, neither he nor Helen realized just how deeply she would know the fellowship of Christ's suffering. The Congo had been a Belgian colony since 1908, but in 1960 it was declared independent. Anytime a colonial government pulls out of a region, it leaves a leadership vacuum in which different people and parties vie for power. So independence in the Congo brought on a series of crises, assassinations, and regime changes that lasted for 5 years. In 1964, the conflict known as the Simba Rebellion broke out in Helen's region. Fighting raged between two groups of Africans, the Congolese National Army and the Simba guerrillas. The missionaries at Ibambi and Nebabongo were caught by surprise. They had grown used to unrest in their country since independence, but it hadn't hindered their work before. They realized this time it was different when Simba rebels arrived at their hospital as an occupying army. Helen and the other hospital workers were at the mercy of the guerrillas. Many of these were adolescent boys who'd been conscripted into the army. Helen described their captors as brutal and drunken. They cursed and swore, they struck and kicked, they used the butt end of rifles and rubber truncheons. They, meaning the missionaries, were roughly taken, thrown in prison, humiliated, and threatened. Helen's most severe ordeal of her captivity happened on the night of October 29th, 1964. Around 2:30 a.m., a group of soldiers forced their way into her cottage. Two male nurses had been sleeping in her front room as bodyguards, but there was nothing they could do to keep the soldiers out. They ransacked the house, smashing whatever they didn't steal. Finally, when she thought they were leaving, the lieutenant, the leader of the pack, commanded her to go into the bedroom and get undressed. Well, instead, she ran outside and tried to hide in the bush. They found her and dragged her back in. One of the male nurses fought to protect her and was beaten unconscious. Then the lieutenant raped her. In that moment, Helen felt completely deserted by God. She lifted up her own cry of, my God, why have you forsaken me? And God answered her. These are her own words from her book, Living Sacrifice. In the darkness and loneliness, he met with me. He was right there, a great, wonderful, almighty God. His love enveloped me. Suddenly, the why dropped away from me, and an unbelievable peace flowed in, even in the midst of the wickedness. And he breathed a word into my troubled mind, the word privilege. These are not your sufferings. They are not beating you. These are my sufferings. All I ask of you is the loan of your body. It's important to me to use Helen's words to describe the peace she found because I can't say that I understand it. It was a peace that passes understanding. Helen didn't attribute her suffering to a God who was two-faced and angry or to one who was unable to protect her. Instead, she saw that the same loving Savior who had meticulously provided a hot water bottle and doll to two baby orphans had allowed her to suffer for him, and she considered that a privilege. Helen also believed God was asking her to thank him for her suffering. She wrote, God was not asking me to thank him for the evil. We never thank God for evil. We only thank him for what he gives us, and he never gives us evil, even though he may permit us to go through evil. Can you thank me for trusting you? He seemed to ask. What an amazing thought. I can understand me trusting him, but I had never thought of him trusting me. I need to mention that in the miserable months that followed, Helen didn't always feel peace. She felt frightened and hopeless many times. But each time she kept walking by faith, returning to her hope that the man of sorrows, well acquainted with grief, was her companion and would not let her suffer in vain. Eventually, the missionaries were removed from Nebabongo and imprisoned along with a group of nuns at a Roman Catholic convent. Helen was held captive for a total of 5 months. Finally, it became apparent that the Simbas in charge of Helen's group were on the run. They moved their prisoners with them as frontline hostages. While they were on the move, Helen was raped a second time. But a few days later, on New Year's Eve 1964, they were rescued by international mercenary troops. Helen was flown home to England, where she spent the next 14 months. During that time, in addition to traveling and speaking, she wrote her first memoir, Give Me This Mountain. She devoted only 7 pages to talking about the Simba Rebellion, and she doesn't ever mention the rapes, although she does in some of her later books. I think at that time she was still too traumatized and not ready to relive it. In the total 10 months that the Simba uprising lasted, 200 American and European missionaries were killed, and thousands of nationals were tortured, beaten, and murdered. The decision over whether to return to the Congo was a hard one for Helen. In addition to the trauma of her last 5 months there, There had previously been some racial tensions among hospital staff. Would they even want her to come back, Helen wondered? Then letters started arriving that convinced her she was not only needed, but earnestly desired. One student wrote, "Don't blame us, doctor, for all that has happened, but pity us for all we suffer. Come back, please. We are waiting for you expectantly. As God enables us, we will see it never happens again." And so in March of 1966, Helen Rosevere returned to the Congo. What she found was pretty devastating. Although the people enthusiastically welcomed her back, 90% of all that had been built at Nyabibango had been destroyed by the Simba army. The people living there lacked food, medicine, and even clothes. Helen took on the work of relief and rebuilding, finding agencies to donate food, clothing, medicine, and building supplies by the truckload. Even as the work rebuilding Nyabibango was underway, Helen was thinking about the future. She had an offer from another doctor at Nyankunde, an area 450 miles away, to build a 250-bed training hospital as a cooperative effort of five mission organizations. Helen had always said, "No white man is justified in working in Black Africa unless he or she is teaching." The hospital at Nyankunde would multiply the number of Africans that she would be able to train, and so she decided to start over again. She moved the 450 miles to Nyankunde. Although they'd been given the land for the hospital, they didn't have housing for students or money to build the hospital. Helen was impatient to get started, and she didn't want to waste a year in fundraising and then building. So instead, she spread the word that qualified students desiring to be trained should arrive the first week of August. 22 students showed up expecting to start classes. To their great surprise, they found no buildings. Helen informed them they must first build the training school. "You build, I teach," she said. The new students were understandably aggrieved. They had come for an education, not to do manual labor. Helen gave them the night to think it over and told them to gather at 6:30 the next morning. No one came. But then at 8:45, the students appeared. They grumbled, but they worked hard. They felled trees and dug toilets, and Helen did whatever the students did along with them. 3 months later, Helen was able to hold her first class in the new training college. Helen faced difficulties at Nyankunde, unlike those at Nyabibango. The government of the Congo in 1966 was a bewildering bureaucracy. Anyone wanting approval for a government-recognized college had to fulfill all kinds of ambitious requirements, like providing indoor flush toilets, something most of the students had never seen before. Meeting all of their requirements proved expensive and exhausting. Helen also faced a lot of interpersonal difficulties. There was a lack of trust between the African students and the white doctors. More than once, students accused the missionaries of financial improprieties, such as stealing government funds or using students as unpaid labor to staff the hospital. The truth was that the missionaries were volunteering their time to try to give the trainees qualifications that would make them employable. After 7 years at Nyankunde, Helen discerned that God was calling her back to England. Her mother's health was not good, and she felt she owed it to her siblings to share the burden of her mother's care. Additionally, multiple bouts of tropical fever had worn down Helen's own health. And in her words, "My own nervous energy was running low, so often tested as it was by mindless bureaucracy or sometimes brutal harassment." Yet she didn't see how she could leave without another doctor to take her place. At just the right time, God provided a married couple of physicians to lead the training at the medical college. But only a few months before Helen left, another student-faculty standoff hit. Unlike the others, this one didn't die down. The students went on strike. Mediators were brought in to no avail. Helen submitted a letter of resignation and was unpleasantly surprised when the hospital staff accepted it. She knew they didn't view her as the problem, but since the students opposed her, they had little hope of resolving the conflict as long as she stayed in leadership. Thus, she faced the end of her time in Africa feeling unappreciated and asking, "Was it all worth it?" She brought her hurt feelings to the Lord and realized that He was stripping her of everything that wasn't glorifying to Him. In her heart, she heard His rebuke. "You wanted to go out with all the trumpets blaring from a farewell do that you organized for yourself with photographs and tape recordings to show and play at home, just to reveal what you had achieved. You wanted to feel needed and respected. You wanted the other missionaries to be worried about how they'll carry on after you've gone. You'd like letters when you got home to tell you how much they realize they owe to you, how much they miss you, all this and more. Jesus plus. No, you can't have it. Either it must be Jesus only, or you'll find you've no Jesus. You'll substitute Helen Rosevere. This feels like an important place for me to mention my gratitude for Helen's honesty. Time after time in her books, she admits her own struggles with pride, and I find it incredibly relatable. One of the most useful things I got out of her writing was her insight that what we often label hurt may really be pride in disguise. She wrote, "When you feel hurt, stop and pray. Hurt means that the self is very much alive and striving to get back on the throne of my life. If Jesus really indwells me, I ought not to be hurt. I may well be grieved at the behavior of others or by certain events, but not hurt. Hurt is a symptom of self. If I let the Lord have his rightful place on the throne of my life, he will handle that which causes the hurt." I'm so curious to know what they're talking about next door. Helen's honesty and self-disclosure is one of the things that made her a popular speaker. She didn't seem like a missionary who was just naturally holier than everyone around her. Dying to herself didn't come any easier to her than it does to us. Well, in spite of her fears and insecurities, she was sent off from Nyankunda with much love and gratitude. The Africans threw a party for her and roasted a goat and spent 2 hours taking turns sharing how her ministry had affected their lives. She left Africa with a full heart and no more doubt about whether she was loved by those she worked with. She returned to England in September 1973. She lived with her mother and wrote her second book, He Gave Us a Valley. She also began traveling within England to speak on behalf of her mission agency. In 1975, she received an invitation to travel to the U.S. and Canada on an extended speaking tour. And because her mother's health was stable, she decided to accept. Just 9 days into her trip, her brother called her to tell her that their mother was dying. Much to Helen's sorrow, her mother died the next day, and Helen felt crushed that she hadn't been able to be at her side, but she carried on with the tour. Then a few months into her travels, she found a lump in her breast. The same old question naturally arose: why didn't God make the way easy for her after all that she had sacrificed? But she knew that suffering drew her nearer to God. He loved her too much to give her a trouble-free life. And although her mother's death and the discovery of breast cancer were low points of that first North American trip, she saw God's supernatural provision once again. In the mid-70s, you needed an actual airline ticket to travel on an airplane. Because Helen was traveling around for months, she had a thick book of tickets. She stayed overnight with a pastor and his wife in America, but needed to fly on to her next speaking engagement on a Monday morning. Her hosts lived a couple hours away from the airport, but needed to travel that way anyway that Monday morning, and so they drove her to catch her flight. They arrived at 6 a.m. for Helen's 7:30 flight, and she told them, "Just drop me off at the curb." When Helen got to the ticket desk, she discovered she'd left her tickets, passport, and all her money on the bed in the house where she had been staying. Of course, her hosts were long gone by this time, and there was no way to phone them. Helen explained her predicament to the desk agent, who informed her, "No ticket, no flight." "But you've got to help me," Helen said. The agent reaffirmed she could not fly without a ticket, but she asked Helen where she was going. Well, Helen had no idea where she was about to fly. She had planned to just simply go wherever was the next ticket in her book. "Do you know your name?" the woman asked. Helen did know her name, so she gave it to the agent and she found a reservation. But even with her reservation, Helen had no way to prove her identity, because her wallet was back at the house. Finally, the ticket agent offered her one possible solution. If she could find someone to act as a guarantor for the flight, to cover the cost if it turned out that she was not, in fact, the ticketed passenger, they would let her get on the flight. Well, Helen didn't know anyone in the city to call. She prayed for God to help her. Then she got an idea. She asked the ticket agent if she had a phone book. She told the ticket agent to open up the phone book and look for someone with the words REV beside his name. The agent agreed and opened the directory to A, she found the first Rev, and Helen asked her to phone him, even though it was still just after 6 in the morning. Helen could only hear the ticket agent side of the conversation. She explained that a woman named Helen Rosevear needed someone to guarantee her flight. Helen waited anxiously while the man responded, but she didn't know what he said until the agent hung up the phone. He said he'll be here in 20 minutes. Sure enough, the American pastor arrived as promised and asked for Dr. Helen Rosevear. He had even withdrawn some cash from an ATM. Well, maybe there weren't ATMs there, but he got cash somehow to take her on her journey. Helen expressed her gratitude, but he said he was the one who was grateful, and then he told her his story. Some years before, when he was not a Christian, he and his girlfriend had been traveling the world. They were in Afghanistan and went to a nightclub in Kabul, where they took some contaminated drugs without knowing it. Feeling really sick, they left the club and stumbled upon the British embassy, where someone from the embassy gave them a lift to a hostel. They got a really bare minimum room, and his girlfriend immediately flopped down on the bed and went to sleep, but he felt awful and couldn't sleep. He found an English book in the bedside cabinet, and he read the book straight through, and then he trusted Christ for his salvation. Helen, he said, it was your book. Give me this mountain. So of all the pastors in a strange American city that Helen could have called for help at 6:30 on a Monday morning, God led her to call one who'd been converted by her writing. The same Lord who had shepherded her through the perils of the Congo stayed by Helen's side through her travels. She finished the American tour and had surgery when she arrived home. Breast cancer didn't kill her. In fact, she was healthy enough to travel for another 4 decades. In 1977, Helen made Belfast, Northern Ireland, her home base, and St. Elizabeth's Dundonald, her church. She shared a house with another Christian doctor, a cardiologist named Pat Morton. Helen really connected with people as a speaker and received invitations from around the world. She spoke 3 times at the Urbana Missions Conference. She wrote 10 books, several of which have been through multiple printings. I'd like to say a word about her books. If you're looking for somewhere to start, her first 2 books, Give Me This Mountain and He Gave Us a Valley, would be a great place to start. She also wrote a memoir of her later life of traveling and speaking called Digging Ditches, and I highly recommend this one. I appreciate that in this book she talks about her own experience of depression. She also wrote 4 theme-based books, Living Sacrifice, Living Faith, Living Fellowship, and Living Holiness. There's lots of stories in all of these, but they're organized more devotionally rather than chronologically. And if you like the story of God's miraculous provision, I haven't had time to tell all of them, but most of those can be found in Living Faith. Helen Rosevear left a rich legacy through her books, through missionaries sent out after hearing her speak, and through the medical training centers she founded in the Congo that are still functioning to this day. Over and over again in her books and talks, Helen would use the word privilege. It was a privilege to minister in the name of Christ and to suffer for him. She fought the good fight, kept the faith, and passed into eternity on December 7th, 2016, at the age of 91. Helen was always leaning into sanctification, allowing God to whittle her into his arrow. In the spirit of her life, I want to leave you with a few applications from her story. The next time you're sidelined from what you consider your ministry, believe that God has a purpose for what you view as a distraction. Just as all the manual labor of building Helen did over the years opened the hearts of her African colleagues to love her, God can use detours from our own plans to accomplish what we don't expect. Second, when you find yourself feeling hurt, ask God to reveal to you your own pride. Grieve, but trust your reputation and your relationships to his protection. And third, when God leads you down a path of suffering, cling to him rather than shrink away in doubt. I pray no one in this room ever has to endure what Helen endured. But if you do, I hope your suffering will drive you into your Father's arms, as Helen did, because he is the healer and he has the words of life.